Hello, and welcome to the Resilient Life Podcast. Resilient Life is part of peakprosperity.com. It's where we focus on practical and actionable knowledge for building a better future. I'm your host, Adam Taggart. When we talk about cultivating resilience here at Peak Prosperity, several themes frequently arise, such as improving our food security, eating more healthily, strengthening our local communities, and building income streams that we have more control over. Starting your own local farm is a dream many hold up as a way to fulfill all of these goals at once. But for most folks, especially those with limited prior experience or capital, it often feels too risky and out of reach. Or perhaps it isn't. Today's guest is Jean-Martin Fortier. Jean-Martin and his wife, Madeleine, are the founders of Le Jardin de la Grelinette, an internationally recognized micro farm known for its high productivity and profitability using low-tech, high-yield methods of production. Jean-Martin has recently published a book titled The Market Gardener, which serves as a handbook for the aspiring small-scale organic farmer. It lays out the knowledge and steps that he and his wife have followed to make a living wage growing high-quality food without a large capital overlay or access to large acreage. The Fortiers generate over $100,000 in gross sales from their 1.5-acre microfarm, with profit margins in the 40% range. They're one of the pioneers of the new sorts of models society needs as we enter a future defined by more expensive energy and greater need for dependable access to healthy foods. I've invited Jean-Martin to the program to discuss the practical steps for setting up a micro farm. Perhaps some of those listening might be inspired enough by this discussion to follow his model. Jean-Martin, thank you so much for making the time to join us today.
Hey, Adam, it's my great pleasure to be with you guys.
Thank you. And you've been kind so far in our pre-discussion, but if I make any real butchering of the French here, please correct me.
That's fine. So far, so good.
All right. Thank you. Well, let's start by having you give us your brief story. How did you and your wife, Madeleine, decide to become farmers?
That's an interesting story because neither of us grew up on a farm. And you know, we met at the university, at McGill University. We studied environmental science and ecology. And when we finished, you know, we knew we wanted to make a difference somehow. We had studied how the globalized system is not so good for the environment and our planet. And we wanted to make a difference in our work, but we didn't really know what we wanted to do. So we ended up traveling for 2 years. And among other things that we did was to work on a small organic farm in Norton, New Mexico. And, you know, before going to that farm, you know, we knew nothing about farming, nothing about the agrarian lifestyle, and even organic wasn't, you know, as big as it is now. And luckily enough for us, we started to work in a beautiful area in Abiquiu near Santa Fe, which is a beautiful landscape. And they had in Santa Fe an amazing farmers market, really strong, strong local support for local farmers. And one of the farmers that was there was from Quebec. He had been there for 10 years and speaking French was something that he hadn't been doing for the last little while there. So we started farming with him, and with this guy, we learned how to farm. We saw what lifestyle he had because he was outside. He was growing food. He was selling it to people that were thanking him, and he was taking a month or two to go to Mexico in the winter. And we thought, wow, what a great lifestyle! And that was our start in farming. We ended up farming 2 years there in Norton, New Mexico, and that farming community was really amazing, and we've been hooked on it ever since.
Wow, great. And so I take it you went back to Quebec and decided to do this full-time back in Canada, is that correct?
Yeah, after 2 years there, we were after working some time with Richard there, we got employed as farm managers for this other small farm because their farm manager left in the middle of the season. So we didn't have a lot of experience, but then we were in our early 20s managing a 2-acre vegetable farm, and we learned a lot there. And we decided to come back to Quebec because that's where our roots are. And we started our own micro farm here on rented land, and we put up a summer camp on rented land. We were, you know, basically we were growing on a garden, and we were bringing our produce to a local farmer's market, and we lived in a teepee for 2 seasons, and we were farming, you know, with hand tools. And I remember Madeleine was the one that would put the seeds in the ground because she was fast at it, and we were doing this by hand. So it really was a garden, and we did this for 2 seasons, And at one point in time, you know, we just thought, yeah, we like this, and we think there's a lot of great upsides to doing this work. So we decided to jump in more professionally, and we bought a 10-acre farm, and which was 7-acre woodlot, and it had this old rabbit house in the middle of it, and it was this old abandoned building. And we bought that, and we built a house inside the rabbit farm. And it ended up being that we had 2 acres of prairie that we could manage to make a living on. And that was the start of our story at La Grelinette.
Well, let's talk specifically then about what you're doing at La Grelinette. So that's truly a microfarm. Is it the same 2 acres of prairie you just mentioned, or is it a separate property?
No, it's the same one. We've had that 2 acre that we needed to manage, and we had to make 2 incomes from it because we both of us wanted to farm full time. And it ended up being that we have 1.5 acres in permanent raised beds. And when we decided on the site, what it implied, because we didn't have more space available, we left out the tractor because we didn't have any room to accommodate the tractor and the spacing that the tractors, they use up for weeding and just for turning at the end of the rows. It's just too much space. So we left that out, and we started to farm a bit differently using, you know, these permanent raised beds that are packed with heavily, densely seeded crops that eventually shade out the weeds. And that's the whole thing with our growing model, is that we're doing intensive spacings, so on not a lot of yardage, there's a lot of production.
Great. Well, let's dive into that then. So when you say intensive spacing, what exactly do you mean, and what types of practices are you using? I've looked through your book. I see you do biodynamic farming, and that might actually be worth spending a moment talking about the biodynamic approach, and I believe you're...
It's actually, Adam, it's biointensive, so there's a bit of a difference there.
All right, let's talk about that.
Yeah, well, what it is that, you know, when we started, you know, the story boils down that we had this land constraint, and we wanted to make the most out of it, and we had already been farming with hand tools. And so the fact that what the biointensive method is, and you can find a lot of books coming from California about that, is that you want to have amazing soil structure and have really, you know, good soil, deep soil, so that you can closely space your crops and still have the roots of these crops really shoot down so that they don't compete with one another. And when you do that, then you have crops that end up, the leaves of these crops, they end up touching one another really rapidly in their growth. And when that happens, it forms a canopy. And the canopy shades out the weeds, and it just retains moisture, and it darkens the soil. So the earthworms and the biology is just enhanced because of this. So effectively, you're creating this living mulch with the crops that you're growing. And this is possible if you're not using the tractor, because usually in a tractor setup, the spacing between the crops is determined by the weeding implement and the tractor itself. So by leaving out the tractor, we were just able to grow these permanent raised beds with crops that are densely seeded and densely transplanted to get a lot of yields, but also to get some beneficial factors with regards to, you know, climate enhancements and the biology inside the soil. And in a nutshell, that's really what we've been doing. We've been building soil here, not turning it, and using minimum tillage techniques and hand tools that really work well. And we've been planting crops really close to one another, like somebody would do in a garden, but we're doing it on a commercial scale.
Oh, very interesting. And so obviously, yeah. I think the spacing is very important. It sounds like the soil itself is very important, too.
Yeah, they work hand in hand, these two,
And I notice in your book there's a big focus on fertilizing the soil, creating your own compost. Obviously, when you're in raised beds, you have the you're growing lots of vegetation repeatedly in the same beds themselves. So how do you keep them How do you keep them active? Do you have to have them lie fallow for a while, or you know, how do you keep since you have such a limited spacing? How do you keep as much of it active as possible for in terms of a productive standpoint?
That has to do with crop planning, because we're planning to have as many successions as possible in our short growing season. We're in Quebec here, and it's not that cold because we're in southern Quebec, but still, it's not California.
And so, I was going to say, it's all relative. Relative to me, it's really pretty cold where you are.
Yeah, well, you know, today it is, but, you know, we have good light, which is important for growth in the spring and in the summer. So we plan to have as many successions as possible. And how we manage this is, you know, successions being, you know, let's say you have a bed filled of radishes, and when you're done with the radishes, you want to have something else taken over. Let's say they're lettuce heads. But you want to have started your lettuce heads, you know, 3 or 4 weeks before in your nursery, so that you have this 3 or 4 week gain in the season. You know, you're growing inside the greenhouse, and then you're bringing your produce out to the beds. And these successions, we plan them in the winter months, and we have a crop planning calendar that we follow that basically tells us what needs to be planted where, and by what is it going to be replaced with, and when do we need to start these other plants that are taking over. And this is all managed in the winter months because we have more time, and then it's put in the calendar, and then basically when spring kicks in and we get really busy, we just follow with a plan. It's a guideline that tells us what to plant, where, when to do our starts, and basically we couldn't be doing all the production we're doing on our micro farm if it wasn't for that planning process. The crop planning is really important.
Yeah, there's one thing I've learned as a novice farmer operating on a micro fractional scale of what you're operating on, and being attuned to when you need to plant and when you need to replace and when you need to replenish is critical in terms of yield management.
Yeah, and when we're doing CSA here, Community Supported Agriculture. We have 140 families that we feed, and we also do two farmers market, which is basically ends up feeding about 250 families, which is quite a lot considering that we're on, you know, an acre and a half. And the reason why we're able to manage this is because we really know in the winter all that we're going to be producing every week. And we're planning this to fulfill the needs of our CSA clients.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that for a moment then. So you're in Quebec.
Yep.
Canada has long and cold, at least from my perspective, winters. How do you extend the growing season? Are you able to grow all through the winter? How do you actually keep production going during those colder months?
We stop in the winter, and we stop for 3 months. So we stop around Christmas and we start again mid-March because it's minus, you know, it's just too cold. We're in Celsius, so I don't want to give a number in Fahrenheit because I don't really know. But
you can just say really cold.
It's really cold, and too cold to really push the limits of farming here. But we like this break, actually, because it gives us time to replenish ourselves, to plan best for the next season. But we push the limits quite far because of, you know, low-tech extension techniques, which are row covers, floating row covers, really amazing. And then we used mini tunnels. We use caterpillar tunnels. We have a couple of permanent hoop houses. We have one heated greenhouse for a nursery in the spring. And it's just this combination of using all of them together. So it's probably hard for me to describe all of this to the listener here, but if they check out the book, they'll figure this out pretty easily. But, you know, you have hoop houses that are, you know, big polytunnels, and then you have mini tunnels inside of them. And you also have, you know, you're growing resilient crops, which might be kale or spinach. They can take freezing and not be, and still be good to harvest. So you're combining these low-tech systems, and you're really pushing the limit of the growing season. So even in Quebec, you know, all the way till Christmas, we're harvesting greens, and then we're starting again in March when the temperatures start to rise again. And it has to do with the light. It really has to do with the light, not as much as the temperatures.
Oh, well, it really is impressive to me, having grown up in New England, that you were able to get a 9-month growing season, essentially, up in Quebec.
Yeah.
And it sounds like, you know, most of that is not in a greenhouse, that's mostly using a combination of sort of smaller, simpler technologies, hoop houses and some of the other things that you mentioned. I should also mention, too, that in your book, there's illustrations of, I think, everything you mentioned there. It's very much sort of a practical manual for what to use and how to use it and when to use it.
Yeah, the whole idea of writing the book was to kind of pass along hard information about what we've been up to on a farm, because when we started, you know, there wasn't a lot of models out there of what we're doing now. And it took us quite a few years to kind of fine-tune our systems and get it right. And at one point, I felt, you know, I think when people, they want to start out a micro farm, because I know that dream is alive in a lot of people, and rightfully so, because we need a lot more farmers to feed these communities. But, you know, farming, even on a micro level, is really technical. And if you're going to be growing 50 or, you know, 40 different vegetables, you need to have, you know, a pretty good understanding of every part of the growing season, you know, the techniques, the tools, know-how. And I've always thought that, you know, a veteran grower that is there to tell you how he is doing everything is a good example to follow. And then from then, you can just pick and choose or make your own experiments, but at least you have one system that you can follow, and rightly or wrongly, you can adjust or whatever. But, you know, cause sometimes you have books that present a lot of models, a lot of ways of doing things, but then when you don't know how to do it, you're confused, because should I be doing soil blocks, or should I be doing this other way of doing my seedlings? And just, yeah, so that was my goal, and hopefully, you know, all of the things that we've developed over time, they can really help other people kickstart their own project and gain a few more years. You know, it took us 8 years to really figure things out, and we've been surfing on that for a couple of years now. But I'm just happy to be sharing what we've been up to.
Well, and it's so wonderful that you are, and that's really what drew me to you. And when one of Peak Prosperity's readers actually introduced me to your work, we at Peak Prosperity, we talk about the need for the new models that are going to bring us into this future that we see is defined by the forces that we call the three E's, but basically that have to do with, at its base, with resource depletion and increased energy and input costs going forward. So finding ways to grow food like this is something that's of great interest to a lot of our readers. And, you know, many of them are discouraged because they don't have the know-how, or they feel like it takes a lot of capital. And, you know, I think many of them would love to have the benefit of a mentor, and that probably would help a lot of people feel more comfortable about getting into this. But one of the things you probably discovered in your journey is, with the rise of big agriculture over the past two generations, there really aren't that many farmers that can act as mentors for small scale or micro farming. Really, they just know the big, you know, industrial input, huge machine farming practices. And so there aren't a lot of people out there for interested parties, particularly young people, to go to and learn how to do what you're doing. So I think the fact that you're being so transparent about it here is a great, great asset and of great value to people. So thank you. And I'd love to dive into, well, actually, sorry, let me let you answer that.
Well, I was just about to say that, you know, I feel that's important. And the farming community, the organic farming community, is great for that, because people, they share. Farmers, they share. And I've done a lot of traveling, and we've learned a lot from different farmers, and then it's about putting all of this together, and, you know, people shared with me, so it just feels right and natural to just pass along, and then, you know, hopefully in the right hands, people will pick up the market gardener and feel it, you know, inspired by it, and then start their own thing, and then bring all of this to another level. And because there's a lot of future in micro farming, and the fact that we don't have a tractor is not because, you know, because we're dogmatic, or it's not even philosophical. It's just we don't need one. We're farming productive and profitably because we're without one. And so this is a message that's kind of new and different, and not a lot of people really believe us. But when they read the book, or even better, if they come and stop and look at what we've been up to on our farm for the last decade, they really see that there's a lot. On an acre and a half, you can grow a lot of vegetables and have employment. And we're basically using no fossil fuel to grow all of our crops because we're using hand tools.
Which is fantastic. And what we've found is that you can discuss something sort of, you know, academically as long as you like. But what really convinces people, certainly to take personal risk, is seeing other people actually go out and blaze the trail before them. And so, again, I think that that's a huge part of the value of what you and your wife have done here is shown people that not only can you generate so much yield from the small amount of acreage that you have, but that you can do it profitably. And that's what I'd like to dive into next year, which is not only have you dispelled the fact that you can generate a lot of revenue off of the small space that you have, but you can actually generate profit and make a good living off of it. So I think that's probably the number one thing that's keeping a lot of younger people from getting into this is the fear that that there's just not going to be enough money in it for them, especially if they have to take up some upfront costs early on in the process. So do you mind talking a little bit about the economics of your operation?
No, I don't, because I feel it's a really important part, just for the reason that you mentioned, because if you want to look at farming as a career, you need to know that you're going to make it out. And so basically on our farm, we're on an acre and a half, and we've been growing here for a decade. And when we started the farm, we bought more or less $40,000 worth of equipment to get pretty much everything going. And this equipment that we're still using now today. And so that was pretty much our startup cost, which is not a lot when you can compare it to, owning, two or three tractors or, the bigger farms, the mechanized farm, how they're organized. And so that our startup costs have always been pretty low. And, we started with 30 CSA baskets, 30 families, and then on rented land we went to 60. And then when we bought the farm we went to 80 families, 100 families, and then we went to 150, 200. And we've been, growing our clientele as we've been growing our skill set also. And for pretty much everything that we've developed on the farm, it wasn't about getting new tools or new equipment. It was just about learning how to grow better. How can we grow more of this without actually expanding the land base because we don't have more land? And it really got us to optimize everything that we're doing on our farm. And so that's why I always talk about, this is not a capital-intensive farm base. It's really a knowledge-intensive farming system. And that's where it gets interesting, because if you can manage to start a little farm without spending too much, and you can still feed a lot of families, and your expenditures are your labor, well, you end up making a pretty decent living. And, we've been making and more than end meats on the farm for a decade. And just by doing things a little bit better every year and just maximizing the output without putting that much input into the farm.
Great. Well, if you don't mind, let me just ask you a couple of rapid-fire questions about
Sure.
the numbers here. So you said your startup costs pretty much were around $40,000.
Yeah, to get all the equipment that we needed, hoop houses, seeding equipment, walk-behind BCS tractor, two-wheel tractor, the implements. It's all laid out in the book. And, so that was the startup cost for the equipment that we needed on a farm. It doesn't count for, having a vegetable delivery truck and these things, but just for the equipment that we needed, it's pretty digestible.
All right. And now after your years where you've gotten up to a fairly mature operation on these 2 acres, what gross revenue are you producing right now?
Yeah, last year the sales of the farm were $140,000 worth of vegetable produced on site. And that's at a 45% profit margin, meaning that, when we've paid, we hired two people now, so we're four of us working on the farm. And when we've paid them, when we've paid these guys, and when we've paid, you know, for seeds and compost and everything that we need, all our expenditures, you know, just a bit less than half comes back to Modelen and I as our salary, which is, you know, not so bad if you compare it to other trades and in the farming world. That's pretty. These are pretty good numbers.
They're pretty great numbers, especially for that small amount of acreage. So that's great. So about $140,000 in revenue. It's you and your wife, and then two employees that you've since brought on, and then the rest really is operating profit for you and your wife.
Yeah.
Great. And in terms of your customers, you mentioned you service about 200 or so families through a CSA model, and then you also go to farmers markets.
It ends up being 140 members of our CSA, and about 30% of our business sales is farmers markets. So we count them as CSAs. We usually say that we feed more or less 200 to 250 families with the vegetables that we grow on the farm.
Okay, great. And so just to repeat those numbers then, it's about 70% of your sales are done through the CSA model, and then about 30 at farmers markets?
Yeah, well, it ends up being about 60, because we also, 10% of our revenue on the farm is for mescaline, which is a salad mix that we grow here that we sell to different restaurants.
Okay, great.
And to the local grocery stores. So that's pretty the breakup of our numbers on the farm.
Okay, great. And I'm just curious, from a food standpoint, when you are talking about the profit that comes back to you and your wife, is that after you've been able to, are you able to eat, are you feeding yourself as well from this land?
Oh boy, are we. We're feasting like kings. And that's the best part of it. We're eating our vegetables for the whole year. We have a root cellar also, and...
Great. So your food costs are obviously very low, and your food quality is very high.
We go to market and we trade with our neighbors for meats, you know, and cider, and all these great things, cheese, all these great things that you need in life. And so, we end up having a lifestyle that doesn't, and plus we don't need to really dress up for work. we're kind of going natural on that way. And there's no traffic jam to go to work, and you just... It just makes a lot of sense for us to have this homesteading and plus having a pretty good living at it. And again, I think we've been managing this because of our approach. And that's really what I wanted to share in the book, because I know that if we need more farmers, then we need to have farming schemes that are more accessible. And it's all about learning how to do it.
Yeah, and we've always agreed you need to have, to get people to move, you've got to give them something positive to move towards, and you certainly seem to be painting a very attractive picture for somebody.
And if I could add something,
sure.
I would also something cool, because you know it's good that it's positive, but it needs to be also popular and cool. And that's how I'm really stoked about how there's more and more recognition about small farmers, how important they are in communities. And I think it's really important that recognition be more and more, because it needs to be a popular trade. If we're going to get, you know, bright people to go into farming, bright and young people, they need to think that it's going to be something desirable. And that's the other thing that I think is important, to get youth into farming.
Well, agreed. I live in an area where small-scale farming is also fairly popular, and it's certainly one of the more, I think, sort of respected professions out here. But boy, if anybody who's listening, you know, works in mass media, you know, maybe a movie around, a movie starring, Jennifer Lawrence as a micro farmer would be a great next thing to do.
That'd be wonderful. Can I play in that movie?
sure. As long as Model N's okay with that.
Well, we won't tell her.
Well, hey, so you have painted, I think, a really attractive picture here. Let me ask you, let's say there's some young person who's listening to this podcast who's really inspired and begins to think that they really want to follow your lead here. What are some of the things that you would say to them, particularly, you know, lessons you learned along the way, maybe helping them avoid some major mistakes, or at least just being wary of things that you learned were really important as you you know, gone through this on your 10-year journey.
Yeah, well, I don't want to be selling out here, but I would say to them, you know, read The Market Gardener and try to pick up the important ingredients in there, because I know that there's not one recipe for success. You know, farming is going to be different in different areas, but I know that there's a lot of key ingredients that needs to be added to the mix for it to work. And so if you can read The Market Gardener, I think that's, you know, if I had a book like that when I started, it would have saved me 4 or 5 years of learning all of this, because it's all laid out. So that would be one advice I would give. And then the other one would be, you know, go work for a full season on an organic farm. And then you'll learn from that grower perhaps everything that he does well, and the other stuff that he doesn't do as well, you'll pick up on it. And most importantly, you'll see if you like it. Because a lot of people, they have this ideal about farming, you know. But you need to put your knees in the ground, and sometimes it's wet soil, and, you know, temperatures are changing all the time. And you really need to commit to one full season, I think, in order to see if you like it and if you want to stick with it. And believe me, if you do like it, probably the chances are you won't be wanting to do anything else, because it's addictive to be outside and to grow crops. And, you know, if you have an outlet where people, they celebrate you for what you're doing, my God, this is, I wouldn't say a perfect job. I wouldn't go as far, but it's definitely a worthwhile, time to spend your, you know, we're going to work more than half of our time spent on Earth is going to be spent working. So you need to find meaningful work, I believe. So that, these are my two advice.
I think
read The Market Gardener and work one full year on an organic farm. And then my third advice is at one point, start your own small operation. You know, feeding 30 families or 30 acquaintances is not such a big thing, and you'll learn a lot by doing it yourself. So there you are.
All right. Well, that's great advice. So, Jean-Martin, so we've got the book, The Market Gardener. I imagine it's available on Amazon and through most other ways to buy books these days. Is that true?
Yeah, it's also available on my website. So, you know, you're buying a book directly from the author. And the website is themarketgardener.com. And just if people want to read a couple of chapters, I've put them out there on the website. And all the tools that we're using, they'll see pictures of the tools and where they can get them. Because these tools, you know, you can't find them at the hardware store. So even if you're just a home gardener, what's great is that, you know, you're learning from a pro. And so the tools that we use, there's a reason for them. And they're basically hand tools that are simple, but they're quite sophisticated in their design to make the work effective and productive.
Well, excellent. And Jean-Martin, I hope we have you back on again in the future to talk in more detail about some of the specific practices and the specific tools that you use. But this has been a great overview to the model that you pioneered. And I really appreciate you being so transparent with the economics, because I think that's something a lot of people don't get. And it's information that oftentimes I think is limiting when people don't get it, because they don't see that it's actually possible to do this and make a living. So, you know, thank you for the work and for the risks and for the really positive picture you and your wife are painting for the rest of us.
Well, Adam, thank you for having me on your show. And I want to thank you, because I think it's important that we talk about small scale farming. And I really believe that there's a lot of future in it, and there's a lot of demand. And I know for a fact that once people, they go to farmers market and they taste real food, there's no turning back. They're not going back to the supermarkets. And the supermarkets, they can't compete with small growers if you're putting a face on your produce, if you're selling directly, and if you're growing top quality, which is really what we're aiming here at the farm. You need to grow top quality stuff, and then you're putting your face on it, selling it directly. And boy, these corporations, they can't compete with that. So the more we are out there feeding our communities, I think we're reclaiming, you know, the local economy. And I believe there's a lot of future in that.
Well, very well said, and I couldn't agree more. So, Jean-Martin, thank you very much.
All right, have a great one, guys.
You too. Bye-bye.